Hey, sexy pants, it's the Nerdist Podcast number 459. Go over to the Nerdist YouTube channel, youtube.com/Nerdist. There's a ton of fantastic stuff that I'm very proud of that's going on over there. We have a good team. We absorbed a lot of G4 folks, Attack of the Show people. I've been calling it G4.1. Attack of the Almost Show. But we have Jessica Chobot's been doing an almost daily show for us, Nerdist News, which is people are watching. She's fantastic. So go check that out. Also, Team Nerdist recently bowled Team WWE. We bowled against CM Punk and Fandango and Kofi Kingston and AJ Lee. So that's over on the Nerdist YouTube channel as well. Subscribe while you're there so you can see more stuff. You don't have to hunt it down. It's just part of your subscription. Why am I telling you how subscriptions work? I'm a jerk. I would like to thank for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast, NatureBox. Healthy, awesome snacks. They almost deliver it right to your mouth. They don't think they offer that service, so you'll just have to pretend that they're delivering it in your mouth. But they will bring it to wherever you want, give them an address, and no, you can't put an address on your mouth. Let's let that go, okay? NatureBox.com. Healthy snacks, delicious snacks, no corn syrup, artificial sweeteners, or flavors. It's a subscription service. Starting at $19.95, you can enjoy and discover healthy snacks on a monthly basis. Each bag is full size. They have 3 to 4 servings of that snack in it. That's a ton of food! Use the coupon code Nerdist for 50% off your first box at naturebox.com. It's only $10. $10 for your first Nature Box. Go to naturebox.com, use the promo code Nerdist, and thank you very much to Nature Box for sponsoring this episode of Nerdist Podcast, which is Jerry Stahl. Now, Jerry Stahl wrote Permanent Midnight, and recently Mark Maron sent me a text and said, "Hey, Hardwick, I don't know if you know Jerry Stahl, but he's a pal of mine, and I think he'd be great on your podcast." I read all of Mark's texts out loud, doing a very poor impersonation of him, but it's all done out of love, right where the love muscle in the center of my chest lives. And so I was like, sure, I'll have him on, Mark. Let's have a little guest sharing program. Well, it'll be like a covalent bond for all you chemistry dorks out there. And so Jerry came on, and he was fantastic. What an interesting guy. He has been through some shit. I've been through some kind of shit. Jerry has been through like a shit Mordor. So, and he's come out the other side. He threw the ring into the fire, and he has his emotional ring into the fire, and he has emerged on the other side. And what an interesting, hilarious, fantastic guy. His new book is called Happy Mutant Baby Pills. It is available now wherever books are sold, so you should absolutely pick it up, and then everything else he's ever written. I think you're going to dig this guy. If you hadn't known before, he's been doing the podcast circuit a little bit, but if you hadn't heard of my other podcast, then you will enjoy the Nerdist Podcast number 459 with Jerry Stahl.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Yeah, but that Christopher Lloyd one was really... Yeah, yeah. It was weird. It was really... We weren't sure what to expect because he's like real old and quiet and slow. And
oh, yeah. He was a little... at first...
He started off a little sluggish.
Yeah,
he was,
yeah.
He was a little tight at first.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then he loosened up.
Yeah.
He seemed to enjoy himself.
He seemed genuinely surprised that he enjoyed himself.
I love when you said you were just going to do 12 episodes and keep him tied to a chair.
Yeah. That's kind of funny. We could have. Even just hearing, like, when he was just talking about, like, his process, I was just like, it's like, wow, it just sounds so beautiful coming from you.
One of my favorite lines of all podcasts was him going, Judge Doom!
I mean, fuck!
Got to play some great characters. Judge Doom, I mean, fuck!
Oh, so you know. You know what you do and who you are.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. That was definitely a... When we first started the podcast, I mean, he was definitely one of those guys for me, like, oh my God, maybe someday.
Yeah.
And then you meet him and you're like, oh, he's just a guy. He's just a guy and he's not really working and he, because, you know.
He's doing that cyber show of some kind.
Yeah, it's a PBS,
I heard you guys talking about it.
Yeah, it's a PBS show. But we're here to talk about you, Jerry. Are you recording? You're already recording. You're so good, Katie.
Oh my God, you're already recording?
She's
that's
that good,
sweet
Jerry.
Preamble.
Yeah, it's good.
Wow.
We'll have to cut out all the Kyle talk and the Christopher Lloyd talk, and then we'll just start
Christopher Lloyd talk is good. Shows that Jerry listened to the show, was able to talk about it.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, yeah.
I listened to some Shine, you know.
Yeah.
Maren turned me on to you guys, actually.
He did?
Yeah, he's a fan.
By complaining about
he's
it?
He's not
or,
a fan.
He was, well, you know, he said, I think what he said was he loves to abuse you, but you like it and you're great friends. Is any of
he
that true?
I liked it.
Didn't you just do a show?
I did just do a show. It was really fun.
I got the impression it was a great experience for all involved.
It really
was, actually.
I absolutely loved it. I absolutely loved working on that show. It's fun because it's a it's basically like a safe zone of truth where he writes
trust
stuff.
Bubble?
It is a trust bubble where he writes stuff and you read it and you go, I know this is kind of what he really thinks about me. But it's okay, and we're kind of making fun of it. And he even said before we shot, he was like, hey, man, if you want to – if there's anything you always wanted to say to me, just throw it in there. Just riff it in there,
that's
you know, or whatever.
World, yeah.
And it was really fun. And so, you know, we did it was entertainingly therapeutic, but I had a blast. It was
I talked to him about it. He said you were really funny.
Oh, did he?
Yeah,
he
said
that's nice.
He said you dug in, and it was cool to see that.
I loved it. And the stuff between him and Michael Ian Black – just fucking killed me. They were so goddamn funny together. So it was it was a good. I had a blast.
Yeah, I just wrote one of them for the
oh, you did?
For the new season.
Oh, nice.
So it's great.
That's really
cool. For me, it's great because you get to hang out in a room full of fucking comedians, which is like
Dave
heaven.
Anthony.
Yeah, because you know I'm like a frustrated stand-up who just put it into novels. So you know, to be in a room and not be sitting in you know the garret.
Yeah,
so it, was
it is
great.
Fun.
Yeah.
Same thing, slightly different medium. Same thing.
Yes, but you have to be all the comedians when you're by yourself. You have to just fill all the voices in your head.
We do have to. Well, that's why most comedians are like the plot of the movie Speed. You can never get below 55 miles an hour.
That's true.
So we don't explode. So that's how we keep the voices down.
I'm going to have to chew on that metaphor, man. That is, but not Speed 2, just Speed 1.
No, boat one? Come on, Jerry.
Cruise control.
Yeah.
I just lost my host.
So wait, so in this case, Dennis Hopper is anxiety.
Yeah, that's right. And is it...
And we have to be Keanu Reeves.
Or Sandra Bullock.
Well,
Alan Ruck? Was Alan Ruck his cop buddy that goes to the wrong house?
No, that was Jeff Daniels.
Jeff Daniels, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Alan Ruck, where did I pull that from?
I don't know. He's everybody else's cop buddy. That's his. That's what it says on his resume.
Yeah.
Cop buddy.
but Mark said, Mark introduced, you know, like he said, hey, you know, my friend, would you guys have my friend Jerry on? He's really cool. And you know, he did Permanent Midnight, a bunch of us. I'm like, oh, absolutely. And I was just reading, I was reading this morning, like, oh, I'll see what else. But your career is amazing. I mean, amazing. Just the TV stuff that you've worked on. Can we talk about Alf for a second, please?
Well, we can talk about Alf. I think worked on might be a little bit of an exaggeration.
Okay.
I sort of slept my way to the middle, and I married a woman who needed a green card who knew a producer.
Okay.
And I had never done TV. I didn't know even where to put the margins. Never heard a final draft. Next thing I know, I'm on Alf, writing a couple episodes. Shooting up in the bathroom, trying not to look at the puppet hanging in the corner.
Mr. Chompers.
Yeah, who I think in real life was like some little Romanian dwarf who like only put in one appearance, you know.
Oh, weird.
It was just, and then there was a puppeteer the rest of the time.
Ugh.
I'm making the puppet, universal puppet.
Yes.
Yeah, for the puppet hands.
Which is also the yap, yap, yap women, am I right? That's that also the
yap, yap, yap puppets, am I right?
Yeah.
That's pretty incredible that, did you never actually write anything for the show?
No, I wrote a couple things for the show, but because of Permanent Midnight in the movie, people think I like invented Alf. So literally on my tombstone will be, he only wrote two Alfs. No matter how many novels, you know, whatever Nobel nod I will never get. It's always, oh, you're the Alf guy.
your next book could be like a Pulitzer and two Alfs.
Yes. Yes. Be lying about the Pulitzer, but not the Elf.
Well, maybe not by that time.
No.
Maybe not by that time.
Well, I think people take you a little more seriously in the literary world when you've got an Elf.
Yeah. I think they do, yeah.
You know,
yeah,
a couple of Elves behind you. It's like, that says
this
literature.
This is a two-Elf book. This is a two-Elf book. You got a couple Elfies.
I give
this
Elf.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Would you could actually, I guess in theory, you could write a, you could title a book hey, I just won a Pulitzer, and people would be like, did you just win a Pulitzer? And you go, no, no, that's just the title of the book. But do you think that that makes it so that the Pulitzer committee would be like, nah, that was kind of lame. He put that in the title.
I don't know that I'm in the running and that would knock me off, but I thank you. Yeah, sure. Had he only not made that lame joke about the Pulitzer, he would have been on the short list. But
who's winning, Stahl? Let's see what he's been up to. What's this?
Oh, my God. Hacky. Yeah.
Never mind. Yeah.
Loser.
Let's take away one of those elves.
P. Pulitzer.
That is funny. I think you're getting the Pulitzer now.
Yeah.
Jonah Ray.
Words are
Pulitzer.
Yeah.
Wow.
So let's talk. Where did you start, and what did you want to do, and did you think
I wanted
you'd
to
end
fail
up
in all genres? That was that was what I set out to do, and I, you know, I've gotten there.
You
pretty
think?
Much. Yeah,
you jazz know, funk. Have you failed in jazz funk yet?
I went with fusion.
Oh, there you go.
I went a little
cover
to the left.
You gotta cover,
I just went a little. I was,
you
know, very Al Demiola.
You say that. You say that I wanted to fail in all genres is kind of I assume is a self-deprecating joke, but it's actually.
That's actually true.
It's actually not a bad goal because
no,
you can't.
You aim high.
You can't really succeed until you fail at things first. And so if your goal is to. Look, if your goal is I want to succeed in every genre, you could be easily disappointed because you're most likely going to fail first.
Thank you.
But if you say, I'm going to fail in every genre, then what you're doing is learning in every genre so that
That's
you
true.
Can then succeed. So
That's
it's actually
true.
Kind of an interesting. And if your goal is to fail, it takes away the fear of failure because that's your fucking goal.
Yes.
So that's really interesting. Did you get my text, Kyle? Oh, you're very nice.
You know, the thing is if when you're – people always say jack of all trades. Like, it's like, hey, he kind of does a lot of different stuff. But you're still – Jack is pretty high up on the
– Sure.
Still the 10.
He's still in the castle. He still lives in the castle. He's not a peasant.
Do you feel like it's important to specialize in one specific thing, or do you think, no, it's good to do a bunch of different
stuff?
I just
love to write, you know, and I spent a lot of years doing research on heroin, so I didn't really get a chance to publish a book till I was 40. So it's like Tennessee Williams, that he used to lie about his age. He would shave off like 4 years and then bust him out. So I don't count the years I worked in a shoe store. You know, so that's how I feel about it. You
God
know.
Damn yeah. it. I never thought about the years that I was drinking, aka my 20s, as research.
Yeah.
That's a really great way to think about it.
Well, you didn't know it was research at the time.
Yeah. No.
For me, it was a great career move. I mean, I got the book out. I had 6 unpublished novels before that, which just appeared in Playboy or, you know, the first chapters here and there. And then, you know, lose everything you have, destroy your health, sabotage your love life, and disappoint your family. And you can get a book. That's what I tell
that's,
the kids.
That's pretty good. Yeah, yeah. You should do that.
When people are like, hey, Jerry, how did you make it? You're like, oh, you know, don't. That's not. You don't need to worry about that.
Yeah.
Take
just,
it from
just
me, kid.
Relax. Yeah.
Yeah. But you can go back and write off all that heroin, though, you know, retroactively.
For tax purposes.
Yeah, for tax purposes.
For tax purposes. Yeah. Well,
if only I'd gotten receipts.
the most professional dealer. It's like, all right, and here you go.
You are, sir.
Yeah, yes. You might want to put this in a safe.
Do you have your parking ticket? We'll validate that for you.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you want us to stamp that?
Yeah.
Oh, look, one more stamp and you get a free heroin.
That's right. Free balloon.
Here's our commemorative spoon.
Oh, hilarious heroin dealings. Mm.
Yeah, the wacky world of hard narcotics.
So what was it? What do you think it was about you specifically that you were... This isn't really something that a lot of people come out of well. Or at least if they come out of it, you know, they can be kind of damaged on the other side. But what was it that you were able to...
Oh, yes, no damage on my part.
You seem fine.
I'm great. Thank you.
But what was it about you that made you... That you think that kind of allowed you to turn all this horribleness into something positive and constructive?
Well, I think... I don't want to use the word artist because it's so pretentious. But if you're like a stand-up or a painter or a writer of any kind, you can use all that pain and suffering and weirdness and humiliation, you know, and do something with it. If you're an accountant and you live that life, you basically just blow your brains out, you know, unless you really get serene and spiritual. But, you know, for people in our particular line of work, if I may flatter myself, you know, it's all material.
Yeah, I guess it is.
Yeah.
And so it sort of makes you feel bad in a way for people who don't have the ability to express to express in some way what they're going through. Like if someone has a, you know, I have a business job and I'm a businessman, yeah, and then I go through all this horrible stuff. Like, what do you think people like that can do to help express the things that they've gone through if they don't have any type of an artistic background to kind of get that out?
Get a ghostwriter.
Oh, nice.
I think that's what they should do. And then, you know, tell the story of, like, the tire salesman who went to hell and back. Rip the lid off that whole thing, you know.
Are you aware that it's happening while it's happening? Like, when you're shooting up in the bathroom next to an Alf puppet, is there any part of you that it's going...
Someday.
But, I mean, is there any part of you that's going, I don't think I should be doing this? Or at the time, are you just too focused on, I just need to get this heroin into my body?
I think it's sort of both. You know, the way it was for me, not to be a heroin spokesmodel, my de facto job description.
You have far too much meat on your bones. You have good muscles. And...
Yes. Well, you know, I got the implants as soon as I,
oh, they're good,
as I could. just because I wanted the painkillers. I think what it is you do these really mortifying shit to get the drugs. And it's so mortifying that you have to get high and obliterate the memory of what you did to get the drugs that get you high, that you need to obliterate the memory of what you did. It's just like a fucking snake eating its tail.
Wow.
Does that
make any sense?
It does. Actually, it sounds like a really fucked up emotional Rube Goldberg contraption.
At best. Yes. Yeah. And I'm sure Rube Goldberg would love that wherever he is now in his complicated coffin that no one can figure out.
No, you
did
see
open.
The burial? It was crazy.
They had to light the candle, which yeah, broke the string, and then this little sailboat went across.
Pushed it forward.
Yeah. Poor Rube.
Yeah.
Everybody's always fucking bagging on him.
What a Rube.
You know, his name lives on.
Was he the Rube?
At MIT.
Is he
the original Rube?
No. Rube has to just be a word.
Well, that's an old carny term. You know, as you probably know, in old-timey carnivals, when somebody was like fucking with you or trying to rip you off, they'd cry Rube.
And
all the carnies would come out and beat the shit out of the person.
And rhubarb used to kind of be an insult, I believe. Like the vegetable, like this rhubarb over here. Maybe some, I don't know.
I was just called a rhubarb.
Someone called you a rhubarb?
And I didn't know how to take it.
Yeah.
Now you can go back and get mad at that person.
You're trying to swindle that person.
Retro anger.
Trying to get him to see the conjoined twins.
Hey, it's Jerry. Remember when you said that thing about rhubarb? You. What the fuck did that mean?
God,
I don't remember.
So sideways, man. Yeah. Yes, rhubarb, the forgotten fruit and or vegetable, whatever it is.
So what is it that you think that, you know, because I'm sure that there are some people who are listening that are struggling with, maybe it's not something as intense as heroin addiction, but it could be some type of an addiction.
Well, you can't compare. As the great Hubert Selby, I don't know if you know, he wrote Requiem for a Dream.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Naked, not Naked Lunch, Last Exit to Brooklyn. I'm confusing my junkie icons.
Basketball Diaries.
Yeah, you know, he wrote all of those things. It's really amazing. And then he recorded, you know, Lou Selby, wasn't that his name? He used to say, you can't compare pain, you know. And because he always used to tell this story once he was in the hospital before there was penicillin and he did tuberculosis and they gave him the shit that made him blind. And he could hear, but nobody knew he was awake. And the doctor would always say, well, at least you're not Selby. He would always say that to the people that were next to him. And so I always remembered that when I was first getting clean. He would say, you know, you just can't fucking compare.
Yeah.
You know.
Do you think you had a predisposition to this type of addiction? Or were you just like, oh, I'm just a regular guy at a prep school. And then one day someone's like, here, try this. Oh, my God.
I always wanted to be a regular guy. But no, I always sort of felt like an outsider. And, you know, did drugs from a very, very ridiculously early age. You know, like from the age of 30. My sister gave me mescaline when I was like 13. I'd never been drunk. God love her. Or maybe I stole it out of a drawer. I don't want to get the woman mad. And I remember just being high as a motherfucker and looking at her and saying, will this like affect my grades? Such a hipster, you know, as I'm seeing screaming buses coming out of the sky, you know, with talking pumpkins.
Did it affect your grades?
They got better. That's the crazy part. Yeah, I took my SATs on mescaline. It was great.
Yeah, I used to hate seeing that, like kids that would just be total, you know, like just like drug kids at school, just like, you know, always stoned or doing acid or just cocaine in the bathroom.
Yeah.
And they would just fucking get all A's. And it always would make me so angry.
Yeah, well, I'm almost half lying. I got half A's and half like, what the fuck is wrong with this guy?
Half unattended.
Half see the counselor.
I was always afraid to do drugs because I don't have the. I'm so prone to getting panic.
Well, heroin, you do not panic.
Oh, well, I'll give it a shot then.
No pun intended. Yeah, I think you should because it'll really. Yes, I think just roll up your sleeves and get to work.
Yeah, sure.
So to speak. Yeah, man, it'll calm your ass down. I mean, it really calms you down. I don't recommend it.
No.
Not these days.
No.
But.
With Obamacare.
Yeah.
Yeah. God knows how much of that shit costs now.
I mean,
yeah.
It's worse than heroin.
although I think in Congress they do get it, they get it free because, you know, they've had health care.
Yeah.
Those fat cats with their heroin for free.
Well, look at Rush Limbaugh. God bless him.
Yeah.
I mean, he did such a service for sobriety because, like, when I was a kid, all the fucking cool guys, you know, Keith Richards and Charlie Parker, yeah. Lenny Bruce. But now you're coming up. It's like, hey, who's doing Oxy? Fucking Rush Limbaugh, this sweaty old bastard. You know, fuck it. I'm gonna switch to something cool. Mm. Yeah.
Hey, did you write the fat? You wrote a Fatty Arbuckle story, didn't you?
I did. I wrote a book called I Fatty
that
young Mr. Depp optioned some time ago.
Was he going to play Fatty Arbuckle in a fat suit?
No. That would have been interesting. No, it was
just
originally...
knowing how obsessed he is with character work, I just assume that...
No, that would have been Philip Seymour Hoffman at the time. But and he was going to play Buster Keaton, Depp was.
Of course.
This being Hollywood, it's one of those projects that I visit once a year and put flowers on the...
Light some candles.
Yeah, on the grave.
Did you do a lot of... Did you find out stuff that...
Yeah, I found out he was innocent and had been framed. You know, the woman who he was accused of raping, Virginia, oddly enough, her last name was Rapé.
Okay.
R-A-P.
Uh-huh. Mm.
She had given half the Keystone Cops the clap, which is
an image
I'm sure you want in your brain. But and had an abortion the day before. And basically the mayor of San Francisco just wanted to, or the DA was running for mayor, wanted some good material. And the head of Paramount sent him a check and said, get this guy, you know, get this guy off our
I want to
books.
See all the Keystone Cops on their way to check and see if they have the clap.
They almost didn't make it because they kept running into each other.
Yeah, exactly. And they took that turn and they all fell out.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
A lot of them never got treated for that very reason. They just kept tumbling out of the car.
So that's what it was. The Keystone Cops were actually competent police officers before that, but the clap made them...
It made them crazy.
Yeah, it made them crazy.
It messes up your driving skills.
The problem.
It was right to the eyes.
Why did they want to get rid of Fatty Arbuckle? Was he asking for more money or something?
Well, he was the first guy to ever make $1 million in Hollywood. And what happened is when that thing happened... Even though, whether he's innocent or guilty, he was so tainted because who's going to find a big fat guy funny after that?
Yeah.
And it was the advent of tabloid journalism. Hearst actually invented, you know, those composite photos where they would like stick a fat guy, in this case Arbuckle, on top of like a virginal waif. They would put these fake, like the Enquirer did it for years,
right.
These other papers. He was the first.
Oh, wow.
And so they just figured, this guy is tainted meat, so we got to dump him.
Well, it's great that Hearst did that because if you've been to Hearst Castle, it was totally worth it.
I think it was just
gorgeous. The indoor swimming pool built on the back of Fatty Arbuckle. I mean, it's a gorgeous property.
Yes, I don't disagree. I think everything he did, all the lives he destroyed, and that talented wife he had.
Yep.
Hearst had. I don't know if you know. He had like a no-talent singer who he would keep paying.
Wasn't that all of Citizen Kane was just making fun of him, right?
Yes.
Yeah. The whole thing was just like he was hated so much that they just did. It was, so the whole thing is basically a parody character piece, Citizen Kane.
It's just an early Funny or Die.
Really. Yeah.
He was so ahead of his time.
Yeah, exactly.
Is there
and yet it lives on.
Yeah. With a movie like this, is it do you hold out hope that someday they might come?
I hold out no hope. I mean, you know, if it happens, it happens. It was nice. It's great to say in interviews.
Yeah.
Until somebody asks you, is it going to happen? Then you have to go, well, I'm not really sure.
Did you replace heroin with anything? Like in terms of
you
even...
mean in Fatty Arbuckle? But or in my life?
No, I think there's a line. I think it's in the movie Get Him to the Greek where he's basically doing yoga a bunch.
Yeah, people do that.
Yeah, and she's like, you can turn anything into heroin. Yeah.
So true. A lot of wisdom in that.
Do you feel like... Because I feel like when a lot of people... you know, when a lot of people quit something and they go, well, I don't feel better yet. And then I've said, well, you'll feel better physically in some to some degree, but the quitting is really just the thing that gets your head clear enough so that you can then start doing the work to figure out why all this other shit was going on. It's like not to make it sound daunting, but just the quitting is really the first step in the process.
Yeah, which nobody gets. They think life suddenly is going to get great.
What? I'm fucking still not happy. Yeah, I know. Well, you weren't happy before, which is exactly why you were doing all that shit. So you got to figure out why you weren't happy.
No, it's tough. I mean, it's like particularly on heroin or booze or anything else. You know, life is very black and white when you're strung out. You either have it or you don't, and you're on the way to get it. And then suddenly you don't have it, and life's nothing but gray area, and you've got to fucking deal with it.
Yeah.
And it's brutal. But then there also is that expression of, you know, with junkies who gain weight, they say they put down the spoon and picked up the fork.
Right. Mm.
Because a lot of people just pack it on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's just, it's some
you
sort
you need
of
something.
Something to control, right?
To fill that God-shaped mommy hole.
Why is that not the name of a thing?
It will be.
God-shaped mommy hole. There's your Pulitzer.
Thank you. Are you listening? Alfred Pulitzer. But you know, it's all material. I mean, this last book, came out of experiences I had, and you end up milking it. Norman Mailer said all writers basically have one story they tell over and over with different characters. And in fact, Hoffman said to me, well, you know, this isn't really about Fatty Arbuckle. This is you just writing another autobiography disguised as a fat guy. I'm always the last to know. You know, who knew?
Were you like, shut up, Philip Seymour Hoffman?
That's a little too close, man.
Come on, man. Just make with the funny voices.
That's my Philip Seymour Hoffman.
I actually thought he was sitting here for a second.
Yeah.
Closed my eyes.
I was about to fall asleep.
That's actually pretty good.
That's fucking great.
Jesus.
That's really good.
Thank you. I'll put it on the SNL reel.
Weren't you in The Master?
Yeah.
Hello, talented Mr. Ripley. He says the name of the movie.
And yeah. Just almost fall asleep and try and say lines.
Yeah. Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
It's like how John DiMaggio taught me how to do Tracy Morgan, which is basically you just pull your chin to your chest. What are you guys doing over here?
Yeah.
Hey, Miss Liz Lemon.
Eric Bauza, who's a great voiceover guy, says to do Paul Giamatti, you have to just try and eat your chin.
Ah, jeez, I got it. God, I fucking hate Merlot.
Oh, my God.
That's fucking fantastic.
Are impressions part of your act?
No, I don't. The only impression I do is of like a Hawaiian guy from back home. That's it.
It's a lifelong impression.
Yeah, it really is. That's all it is. And I put it on a bunch of different people.
Yeah?
Yeah. But that's I don't do impressions. I like doing them. Yeah. I like doing them for fun and in
conversation. You're like a Frank Gorshin guy where you do that thing on like the Ed Sullivan show where they turn around and then turn back around.
Yeah. And I just pat my hair down.
Yeah.
And turn around.
Yeah. Who is he?
Yeah.
Now he's Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Oh.
I want to talk to you a little bit about writing porn for Hustler magazine.
Yes. Let's do that.
That sounds awesome. Did you write?
Sound, that's like the Chris Farley show.
Remember when you? Well,
it's a funny story.
What's exciting? What I love about it is that you know you like as a kid you'd read these magazines and be like, what crazy encounters people have, and you're like, no, that's just a fucking guy in an office who's writing this.
I never thought it would happen.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, those are the fake penthouse letters that I used to write. Yeah. Which years later, guys like, God, I jerked off to you. That is just gross. But it was even weirder with Hustler because I was the humor editor, and it is known, you know, as the humorist.
Yes.
Magazine.
Yeah.
And my gig was people would send like genitally shaped fruits and vegetables from like Nebraska. And I'd have to write a gag about that squash that looks just like a. And years go by. And you're just like, wow, I went to college.
Yeah.
This is great.
Yeah.
But it was exciting. I got to, you know, live in a YMCA in Columbus with a bunch of guys with black lung disease. And then I was there when Larry got shot in the stomach.
Holy shit.
It was a crazy time.
You
that
were?
Is a crazy time.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a long time ago. It was right when I took the gig because I wanted to move to LA and it was a freeway to move to LA. I knew they were moving. So, stayed 6 months, just long enough to get unemployment and see a lot of very weird shit. But I think that thing you said about you expect these wild guys. I thought I'd go into the office and it would be these wild fucking women. I get there and they're showing me around and they open this door and there's like ladies in like beehives, like Aunt Bee from fucking Andy Griffith, like stuffing dildos in boxes. I'm like, this is so not what I thought it would be.
This is like that Simpsons episode where Bart sees the door to Mad Magazine and he opens it up and it's just the most, you know, the fantasy of just Alfred E. Newman going, hey, get out of here.
Yeah,
that's what you want.
Yeah. Yes, it was not that. And yet I was weirdly aroused by a room full of Aunt Bees. So.
Well, they are putting a dick in a box.
Yep.
Nope. I can't even top that. Yes, they were putting a dick in a box.
Yeah, they're packing dildos.
Yeah, back in dildos.
So from there, you know, it, when
my
that's
next memoir.
Did you ever have a long term plan? Did you ever?
I was not a career guy. I just wanted to write. You know, I really wanted to play music, but I sucked. So I just wanted to find something you could basically do naked, alone, and fucked up at 4 a.m. and maybe make some money. You know? And writing was that. So back then, you know, I'm like older than your parents probably, but you know, in the 70s and shit, like there were really funny ass novelists, you know, and I wanted to be one of those guys. So I'm succeeding very well. If this was the 70s, I would be killing
if you were just a layer today on the 70s.
So no, I never had a plan. The word career was not I always wanted to do stand-up, but I was basically too fucked up to stand up, so I just always wrote books.
Wow.
Because, I mean, at least now someone wants to write. Oh, they can just put it on the internet somewhere. And if someone happens
But at the time,
you're a writer, you basically have a typewriter and you have stack of pages.
That's right.
And then what do you do with them?
Well, what I did was get rejected from a very early age. I started sending shit out. I had 6 novels before Permanent Midnight came out that never got published. And there I go bragging. Sorry. So, you know, you just, I did a lot of journalism for a lot of years and this and that, and then fell ass backward into TV. And then when Stiller did, years after the dope thing, when Stiller was going to do Permanent Midnight, the money fell out. So he asked me to write a movie with him, this thing, What Makes Sammy Run. That's how I sort of got it really into quote unquote show business, you know, writing that stuff, was working with him.
Did you, was it weird to see it? Was it weird to see the movie? Or did you have a certain sense of, did you have some separation from it?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I didn't write the movie, so I was a different kind of asshole in the movie than I was in real life or in the book. But yeah, I mean, seeing the worst moments of your life reenacted by movie stars 9 feet high, you don't need therapy after that.
Yeah.
You know,
Does it help?
Well, it sure hits home that you were a dick, you know, and it definitely, I would say, I'd recommend it for everyone. If you can make that happen,
if you can make
plus,
a movie
plus you're,
your
in stellar, you're in stellar company, you know, like Larry Flint.
Yeah.
You know.
How do you, because obviously it's really important when you see that and you go, wow, I was a dick and I can't believe I did all these fucked up things. And
yet they made a movie about me and had I been noble and well-behaved, who would give a shit?
But how do you... what's the process that you go through of forgiving yourself and being like, look, I can't be any more sorry than I am. Like how do you forgive yourself at that point so you can move on?
I've never forgiven myself. I think eventually you realize that it's just another form of self-indulgence to keep beating the shit out of yourself. So you know, sort of try not to, because if you feel all that guilt, you're going to be the guy who walks into a room and just like radiates self-loathing, you know,
right.
Which God knows I've been for years before I realized that people were passing out when I walked into a room. So I think you do it as much for other people because it just becomes a fucking bore, you know, to carry that cross around.
That is interesting that you said that it's self-indulgent. I guess excessively beating yourself up can be kind of narcissistic in a way, right?
And it was also, you know, my family business. You know, I come from a long line of self-loathers, so that was the Stahl family.
And I say this as someone who's prone to doing that kind of stuff,
really?
Too, of like...
It's funny, you seem very positive. And you are that guy who walks in a room and I have the opposite reaction when I walk in a room. People don't cringe.
No. Well, they do. They do. I'm sure they do. Like, what's he going to host an after show in here? But I think...
Come on now.
I think the reason that I'm so positive is because I'm so prone to being negative.
I understand, yeah.
Like I'm positive a lot of times in spite of myself.
Yes.
And when I go home and I've been trying to radiate positivity all day and try not to, you know, let the cracks of pieces of what is probably the real me through, then I go home at night and I can just get kind of empty and negative and, you know, like it all.
That's the show I want to see.
I want to see the after show for your day.
Yeah.
Fucking.
Welcome to
up.
Talking. Fuck you.
I really do feel like for most people, not all people, but for a lot of people, I think happiness is a choice that you have to make and you have to work for it. You have to work for it because it's happy outcomes if you're not really trained to seeing what can be positive about a situation. I mean, you can take positive and negative out of a situation, but I think we get much more comfortable with things that are negative because it's easier to predict that outcome that something might not work out. So it's just going to get ruined.
That's right. Yeah.
And that's really just a narcissistic control issue, I think.
I think you're right. Yeah. It's that warm bath of misery.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Why try? Because this is just going to. Yeah, and then, you know, because we're usually very sensitive people and we've been hurt a lot. And it hurts to be disappointed and it hurts to lose things. And so
I think that's the biggest part you have right there is like you don't want to be disappointed. So if you assume the worst, my wife has a knack for that of just being like, it's like, well, it's going to go bad or that person's going to turn out to be shitty. So I don't want to become friends with them. You know, if you just assume that someone's going to just fuck you over, you're just going to not
you kind of end up making it happen. Not
self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. But I am not prone to quoting the Dalai Lama, but he did say many years ago, because I'm not a guy who like reads a lot of in-depth philosophy, but I have a book of Bartlett's quotations next to my toilet. And he said that happiness was the last radical act of the 20th century way back when. And it's true because things are so negative and so fucked up that it really is like the sort of craziest, most insane thing you can do is be happy and kind of keep those around you from being miserable.
Well, I think it's very telling about our culture that as someone who I would say tries to stay positive most of the time, and I've been accused of being fake or inauthentic because I'm positive, and I don't feel like I am, but you know, I think we're in a time in our culture where people view negativity and cynicism as somehow more real than being positive. And my feeling is like, well, they're both equal. I mean, like some, you know, but why do you think people see that as more true necessarily than
negativity?
Yeah.
Because life is so shitty.
It can be, but it can be good too.
And it can absolutely be good, but I think the art of it now is trying to be happy in spite of the reality so many people are facing. You know, if you can find a way to transcend. God, listen to me. I want to smack myself in the face right now.
No, it's good.
Because I'm being positive and it sounds negative. But I think the reality is, you know, it's such a harsh fucking time and so many people are suffering that I don't think you want to be happy. You know, like, oh, it's all, like, I hate people who say it's all good. It drives me fucking crazy.
It's never all good.
I'm so glad you said it, because I only say it's all G, and I'm glad.
Well, you stop it. You stop it, though.
No.
It could be it's all grimy. You don't know what you're going to fucking say.
Yeah, that's true. It's all goo.
It is. It really is.
Yeah.
But I think it's much easier, but also it's taken less of a risk. You know, I get accused of being negative in my novel, especially this last one, because it's all about all the chemicals and shit and the food and malformed babies from like eating GMO corn. So it's a lighthearted romp.
Sure.
But if you're funny on top of that, that sort of de facto says, well, you know what? You laugh anyway, and somehow you get through.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and that's maybe the most power you have at times, which is not to add to the shit that the world is already
dumping on you. I'd rather stay positive and have moments of being disappointed in something or someone than, you know, living a negative life and then occasionally like going like, oh, I guess that wasn't so bad. I'd rather have it. Sure. Like, you know, I'd rather have the more of my life, you know, the fraction of it be higher and happier.
So you and your wife sound like you're complete opposites.
Yeah.
How does that work? Does she get mad at you for being a Pollyanna?
She'll stop trusting people so much, or, you know.
I don't want to analyze women because I don't know her, but has she been burned or what happened?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I can track about, I don't even know if this is like right to talk about, but like her dad left twice when she was growing up. Like he like left the family and then he came back and then just left again.
Did it again?
Yeah, he did it again.
Oh, that is hard. Well,
yeah, it's harsh. And so kind of I think radiates.
She got some trust issues.
Yeah. I had to break her in. I had
so
like,
you left a couple times. Just
yeah,
so
no,
you would come back.
I had to go. Like it's like, hey, I'm not
your dad.
Yeah, no, because she would be like, if you want to break up with me, you can. That was happened a lot early on in our
that
relationship.
That is sexy when somebody says that.
Yeah. Oh, can I? But wow. Yeah, there was a lot of me having to just go like, it's like, no, I'm not going anywhere. You know, I'm not going. I just, you know, I had to let her know that because I can't blame her because that's a crazy thing to happen.
Of course,
it's just it's like, hey, you're leaving? Oh shit, this is crazy. Oh, dad's back. Awesome. Everything's going to go back to, hold on.
Oh my God. Yeah. Well, you know what Hemingway said, you know, the greatest gift for an artist is an unhappy childhood.
Yeah.
So I don't know if maybe he was just giving her a gift in the hopes that she would be an artist.
And she is. She's a great one.
Well, there you go. It all worked.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I think it's, you know, I think the world has always been a really fucked up place. I just think that now it's so interconnected that we're aware of it.
Yeah.
And obviously the misery has scaled up exponentially because, you know, now there are 6 billion people on the planet as opposed to, you know, 1 billion people on the planet. So not only are we more aware, but there are more people. And so, you know, it's just the proportionally the misery has gone up. But then I also think there's still good shit too. And we have to, you really have to not be disrespectful to the bad shit, but also, you know, fuck man, how long do you want to be miserable? You know, it's just not worth it, especially as you start getting older and then you start going, yeah, I'm not going to be here forever. And I probably at some point should try to, you know, at least if I'm going to be miserable, at least maybe if I could be happy to make other people happy, at least there's something there, you know, like, I don't know, but it just doesn't.
That makes sense.
I don't want to get to be at the end of my life, which hopefully will be in 30 or 40 years. And then as I'm dying, go, everything would have been fine. I should have just chilled out, you know?
Yeah, I don't think anybody says on their deathbed, I wish I was more negative. You know?
Yeah.
God damn it, I was so positive. Yeah. Why couldn't I have been
me.
More
I mean,
negative?
But it's tricky. I mean, I just had another kid, you know, and when you have you bring a kid into this world, cornball as it sounds, everything feels more urgent, like reading about water wars in 2020 you know. The fact is not going to, you know, food riots. And you're like, Jesus Christ. Yeah. So the least you can do is try to be positive so they have some fucking defense against the looming shit cloud, which may or may not be about to rain.
Yeah, it's not good to be a sky is falling parent.
No, I was raised by a couple of those. And then what they did was basically pull the sky out and throw it on me. So, you know, it has a long-term effect.
But you have an older daughter too, right?
Yes, every 23 years I pop one out. Yeah, that's my gig. I pop out another little girl every 23 years.
So what?
In fact, I'm so old now. The trick is, excuse me for interrupting,
please.
Is like, will I be in diapers before she's out of them? That's the eternal question I'm staring at.
Unless
down the
you're into infantilism, which you wrote about on CSI, right?
I did, yes. Thank you for bringing that up.
Of course.
Yeah. There's a transition. Yeah.
That's pretty good.
That was a great segue. Yes,
hey,
I did.
Great job, Chris.
Thanks, man. Well, he said diapers, and I just went with it.
You went with
good, free association, and it worked out.
Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, what I love about things like CSI is, you know, I got to do some of them more darkest, fucked up, strangest, quote unquote, another word I loathe, transgressive, very trendy literary term, material like the 9 o'clock Family Hour on CBS that I ever did in a book, but I had like 20 bazillion people looking at it, which is kind of cool, you know? But I stirred up controversy because not just in that one, but I also wrote about plushies and furries, and I confused which were the people who fetishized by dressing as a cartoon character animal with those who just dress as like an animal. And they apparently picketed in front of CBS because they were outraged.
That must have been an adorable picket line.
I think it was just to die for. I mean, if you
I like the idea too that there's just be a bunch of, you know, plushies or furries outside of a place, and then there's kids walking by going, "Hey, look at it! This is some good family fun going
look
on
at
here."
This sexual fetishism.
Yeah. Why are they wearing leather panties?
Yes.
Yeah. Why does that sign say "Keep your writing off my coming"? I don't understand.
Oh,
what that mean. I mean, what does that mean?
Wow. Keep your writing off my E.E. Cummings.
Yes. And let's write in all
hated capital letters. Hated capital letters.
Hated
capital letters.
He wrote that book, The Big Room. It was very crazy.
Yeah, and then
look,
kids
we're all
today,
dropping like literary references.
Kids today, they all caps. They love all caps.
Do they?
Only
it's
when
like
they're excited.
They're screaming at you.
Yeah, that's all it is.
They're just screaming.
Yeah, yeah, and they hate vowels too. Internet speak. They take all the vowels out.
Yeah, it's just quicker.
Well, if you're on Twitter, I mean, you need that vowel space.
That's true. That's true.
So what did you what were you able to so with this Sky is Falling family that you had, and then you have a daughter who's 23. What did you impart to her when she was growing up?
Well, I shudder to think what I imparted to my older daughter, who has transcended and is herself a writer, who's writing a book with one of the all-time great titles to me, Am I a Bad Conversationalist? A new book by Stella Stahl to look out for soon. Because now I'm the subject and the butt of all the humor, the way I talked about people mercilessly in Permanent Midnight. And now it's like, ow, fuck, that hurts. And it's like, well, I guess that's how it works. I think I imparted that you probably shouldn't do drugs, because I was that guy when she was growing up. And then I became like the celebrity junkie, which every kid wants as a dad, so that on PTA nights, all the parents would like move to the other side of the room where we entered to sit. Ew. Like the kid.
That means you're famous. That's
night.
What people love.
Well, it means you're kind of creepy and dangerous.
Oh, right. Okay.
And,
right.
He's
too.
The heroin guy.
Sure.
And,
leather pants.
What's with the leather? I love the leather. Just the leather panty thing. Yeah. I'm wearing them underneath. Right
it's
now.
Good. It's good. It's fun. Quicker.
It doesn't breathe though.
Mm-hmm.
No, but it keeps everything in.
So true.
Yep.
Almost everything.
Yeah. So at what point did you feel like you had to sort of go back and mend anything with her? Or were you just like, hey, I'm okay now? Or was there a
no,
moment?
No, of course. You know, there's that lifelong sense of, man, that was fucked up. But I think you do that thing where you just try to live a stand-up life now. And, you know, maybe the lesson is, you know, people can change, you know, but Jesus, you'd have to talk to her because, you know, there's probably an issue or two there, you know. But I think I might have made her an artist.
Yeah.
You know, in the Hemingway sense.
Well, you know? my parents, well, my dad, like, you know, did a lot of coke and smoked a bunch of weed and drank and stuff like that when I was
didn't
growing
know
up.
That. Yeah.
Did I say that you would know it? Or did I can't remember.
I felt like I should know it.
No. But it's just it's a thing that happened. And I tell people that, and like I go, oh yeah, my dad was, you know, doing a lot of blow
in front of you.
No, kind of. There was a lot of. You
I
know,
mean, if he's doing it off your back, you're not really seeing it.
Yeah, I can't see it, but I can.
Daddy's
hear it
tickling
and I can
me.
Feel it. Yeah, yeah.
With his nose.
Yeah, yeah.
Nose tickles.
That's so cute.
Another ski trip pop. But you know, and I didn't understand. I knew it was drugs. I knew it was bad, and I knew he had a real problem. There was always like, you know, Dad might go away for a bit, kind of like conversations here and there, and a lot of erratic behavior. But when I got older, and I think there's a big part of like of growing up and becoming an adult is forgiving your parents. It's kind of a thing where it's just, you're like they're just a human being that had made mistakes just like anybody else, and it had nothing to do with me.
Yeah,
and so that was a big part of it did at the time. Right. I was confused and I didn't understand certain things were, but you know, coming from a childhood of just parents doing drugs, I came out of it going like, well, it had nothing to do with me. I forgive them. They're just people.
Well, that's pretty enlightened.
Yeah.
I mean, my old man kind of like checked himself out when I was 16, kind of went into the garage and, you know, did the old exhaust routine.
Grief.
Which, fun fact, people try to do that now and they don't realize with unleaded gas, they're just going to get a headache and they just sit in the garage for like 2 days feeling weirdly nauseous and they never go anywhere.
It's like putting your head in an electric oven.
Kind of like that, except... Probably not as hot.
Yeah,
but yeah.
I didn't know that. That's awesome.
So, but what that teaches you is a very strange lesson. Which especially when you're like at 16, you're like, well, fuck it, nothing matters, you know.
Yeah.
And you get that lesson into your head, which probably not a good one, you know. But I think the best you can do with a kid is just try to like fuck them up in the opposite way you got fucked up, and hope somewhere in the middle.
And especially, I would imagine at that time, if you were 16, and was that in the 70s?
Yes. Well, that wasn't actually in 69.
69. So in 69.
I'm an older gentleman.
You're an older gentleman.
Thank
well, you,
you
look good, though.
Thank you so much. Talk to my liver.
It's in 69, that's not really a time where people are like, oh, something horrible happened. We should get these kids into therapy and try to work it out.
Oh, God,
and really,
no.
It
this
was like,
way
don't talk about it.
Pre all that.
Keep it in the family.
Yeah.
You know, only crazy people see doctor, you know.
Yes. Yeah. Well, there was a lot of that in my family. Yeah, a lot of craziness. Not to tell tales out of school, but I mean, I've written about it all. But like, yeah, but we think my mother was going on vacation and she would be going to Western Psychiatric for Edison medicine, you know, for the electroshock, which back then people still did, you know. So I think it is sort of a gift having that, because as you grow up, you sort of realize you might as well be fucking happy, because otherwise you just, you know, you're not going to beat the odds. You know, it's too, you just find your cliche, right? You know, and the cliche of being sort of the black leather dark guy, it just gets tired for me after a while. You know, I was the guy who came to LA, continued to dress like I was on the subway at 3 a.m. and scaring off the muggers, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I'd go to the beach in a fucking black leather trench coat. It was pathetic. You know? I just didn't get how to make the transition.
Yeah.
You know, so.
So ultimately, do you feel like you won or succeeded? I mean, it seems like if to come out of the upbringing that you had and to come through.
Which a lot of people have. I don't want to sound like mine is, you know, the worst.
No, that's
people
true. But it was pretty bad.
It was tricky.
If both
yeah.
of your parents had
yeah, it was tricky. Yeah.
psychiatric issues and your father sure. committed suicide yeah, when yeah, you yeah. were young, I mean, like, and then to go through everything that you went through and now, like, you know, you have what I presume is a good relationship with your daughter and things are going well and you're working and you're helping people and you're talking about it. I mean, do you feel like you've succeeded?
Well, I feel like I did that, and I think the great gift of going through all that is you get to tell other people what happened, you know, so that they don't feel so fucking bad about themselves.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Because I know if you just think you're the only one who went through that, you feel creepy, you know, but I think essentially all our secrets are the same, you know, and if you let that out, people... I suddenly felt like Billy Graham Jr. just for a second.
Just for a second.
And I creeped myself right out of my socks. Yeah. But you asked the question. I'm trying to, you know.
Yeah, no, it's good.
I think that is the best you can do, is just sort of show people that, you know, what the fuck, you know. But it you know, it's still a fight. You know, it's like running up a down escalator just to stay in the middle, you know. If you're not sort of vigilant spiritually and emotionally, or however you want to call it, you know, I'll go back down. Just like you were talking at the end sure. of the day, your natural state is not to be like an upbeat guy, but you work at it and you do it because you think that's important.
Well, I just think it's a ground state, because I think you have, you know, you basically have this economy of, there's this economy of energy that
that's
you
have.
That's
a great way to look at it, yeah.
And so you can only devote it to so much, and I think that means like physical and mental
sure.
stuff. So in
yeah.
terms of, you know, if you're devoting too much energy to one thing, you might get physically sick because all of your energy was being mm-hmm. devoted to this other thing and not fighting off germs.
But has balance come easy to you?
It's coming a lot easier because right. because I recognize. I mean, I weirdly. Even though I don't love them, I respect the power of my imperfections. I know that I can easily be consumed by the things that are bad about me. And so because I know that that's a thing, I think that makes me more comfortable because, yeah. you know, like if I feel anxious or if I feel, you know, I can go – rather than feeling like I'm a victim of it, I can go, that's a thing my brain does. That's just a thing that happens, and so that's not really a real
that's
thing.
That's not me.
It's not really yeah. a real thing, and I don't have to. Yeah. I don't have to give into it.
Sure.
Just because I feel something doesn't mean I have to give into it. Which yeah. I guess is how you.
Yeah, feelings aren't facts.
They're not facts.
Yeah,
they're not facts, and it's, you know, it is sort of a weird dialogue that we have with our brain, and I really had to learn that you don't have to listen to your brain all the time.
Well, what made you negative? I mean, why is that your state? What, did you have a childhood that was interesting in its own festive way?
My childhood was somewhat tumultuous. My parents hated each other and
well, that's a great example right out of the gate. Right?
It was. My
a lot of public fight. I mean, just like fighting in front of you. And
yeah, fighting in front of me,
ah,
you know.
The worst.
And so
that's scary.
It was tumultuous, but I also feel like I think this is true for a lot of. I'm just hypersensitive. I'm a very sensitive person,
yeah,
and so,
yeah.
like I said before, it's easy to get negative because you're trying to control the situation because it's devastating when you're disappointed, like or
sure,
you know, it, or yeah. when you feel sadness, you don't just like oh I'm bummed. You really feel sadness. So like you really do have to learn that. You really have to learn to try to respect all of your emotions and go, yeah. well, if I'm sad, I guess I just need to be sad. Like, you shouldn't be so afraid of feeling things.
But that's almost un-American because now we're supposed to take a pill for it. You know, I mean, I'm by nature a catastrophizer. I mean, everything is like, if I feel bad, it's always going to be fucked. This is it.
Right.
And you just realize, you know, everything changes if you just fucking sit there. You know?
What's the book? Yeah. It's the name of, is it Happy Fun Pills?
Close. It is.
Happy Mutant Baby Pills.
Yes. Thank you for asking.
Yes.
Yes. Which is a bit about that petrochemical pharma industry that we all love. Because one of the characters, a guy who writes side effects, he's like a failed writer. He grew up like the classic guy who reads the backs of cereal boxes and wants to be Hemingway, then grows up and writes the backs of cereal boxes. Really so funny. He's the guy who came up with like anal leakage.
Side effect include.
Because, you know, he worked with seepage is very kind of horrible and gross, but like... leakage is kind of around the house, you know, faucets leak, tires leak, and it makes it kind of palatable.
For Olestra? So
that's his claim to fame, yes, for Olestra. and other leakage-oriented products.
Leakage-inducing.
Yes.
Is there a pill just for anal leakage?
To make it happen or to make it stop?
To make it happen.
Oh, okay. Because if you want to make it stop, you could just put the pill in your butt to plug it.
Then it's a suppository.
I guess.
That doesn't plug it. Suppository will smooth the exit because, you know, in France.
Yeah, you fucking idiot, Jonah.
Well, I suppose if you kept it in a wrapper,
that
would plug
just
the shit out of it.
The pill like bottle. You put the pill bottle, and that's the plug.
I rest your case. Yeah.
I rest your case!
Yes, very true.
That's good.
Yeah.
I think there's certain times where in my life where I've thought about, like, it's like, I go, it would be so easy if I could just... like take a pill and I wouldn't have like anxiety or have these bouts of, you know, feeling sad. And then it's just one of those things when you're in the shit, you don't think there's no light at the end of the tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
And it's every time I kind of come out of just a little bit of a slump or a stupor, I go, oh, good thing I didn't go and get fucking pills for this.
Yes, because now I'd be in withdrawal.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel like I started a... More at the behest of Chris telling me, like, he's like, you know, if you get on a regular workout regimen, you won't feel the need to.
I totally agree. I think the answer is physical. It's not more talk for me, just personal.
But it's all the mind body thing is incredibly tied.
You just keep yourself kind of going and keep the blood moving around.
Yeah. No, that's Chris was telling me that for years. He's like, if you just. It won't happen. It'll still happen. Yeah, it's really hard to start. And I was never like a physical guy, but you know, once you like, you know, get into it, it's just you don't even think about it anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it doesn't come natural.
No.
You know, clearly the three guys sitting at this table, we're not born with the happiness gene necessarily. No.
Well, I just think it's important to feel the things that you're supposed to feel, and taking pills are not feeling things. I'm sorry to quote the worst Star Trek movie, but in Final Frontier, there's this whole thing where Spock's brother basically takes away all of their pain, and they just get really like, just like starry-eyed and blissful. And then and then Kirk's like, I don't want to. He says something like, "My pain is what makes me who I am."
Yes.
And you know, even though it's not a great movie, it's a really valid point
that is.
I feel like it's important to feel those things because they do shape you and especially in your case, you can take those things and you can do something constructive and you can do something positive and you know, I'm sure you don't look back and go, hey, it was really awesome, I did all those things, but on some level you must kind of feel like, hey, I'm kind of glad I went through that so that I could be the person that I am now.
Sure. Basically, it's like, I couldn't be here if I didn't go there.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, which is not the worst feeling in the world to have. But a person with your attitude is basically the pharmaceutical industry's worst nightmare. Because with people like you who say, I'm actually going to feel my fucking feelings and, you know, just do that thing of like, don't just do something, sit there, you know, don't take a pill. What would happen to the antidepressant industry? What would happen? And I, no knock on, you know, if that works for you, God bless, you know, but most people, I think, in America feel like if they have a feeling, they need to medicate.
Yeah.
The two guys I've known to commit suicide were, you know, they weren't the most depressed guys, but they got on meds and then they tried to get off. That's when they did it.
It's
brutal. And again, it's like you said, there are definitely people who need to be chemically balanced. But I think everyone would admit that a lot of people taking these drugs do not need these, you know, like they really don't need that. So it's good, you know. I don't know what the solution is. I guess hopefully you're lucky enough that you have a good doctor.
Well, I'm always, whenever the doctor has whatever pill he is prescribing, it's like written on the pen that he writes the pad. It's like dead giveaway.
That's how you know.
You're just like, you know what? I'm just not feeling this is necessarily called
so
for.
So you have a closet full of these samples?
Yeah. Yeah. Dr. Kickback.
Yeah. Sure? It's like a real Usual Suspects moment where you flash back and you just see the brand and the pen and the pad.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
It's pronounced Kickback. It's German.
Oh, Kickback.
Yeah, it's not Kickback. Yeah.
That's funny.
Well, we're at about an hour, which is good, which is a funny way to say that because this was a nice therapeutic session.
Thank you.
Happy Mutant Baby Pills is out now, I assume, not only in hard copy, but also places where you might purchase digital downloads of things.
It is everywhere. It's on tape. It's online. It's ebook. It's all your...
And thank you to Mark Maron for kicking your name over to me. I really, really appreciate it. This was really great.
Kick it over. He was like, fuck him.
You know what? Get him out of my life.
I mean, honestly... You know, come back every so often.
I'd love to, man.
Just hang out with us.
Great.
Check in.
Yeah.
Cool. Thanks, Jerry Stahl.
Thank you. I feel so much better and refreshed.
I think we figured it out, guys.
Yeah, you can use the back door.
I assumed I would have to.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.